I'm Greg Johnson. Welcome to Countercurrents Radio. This is the after party for the discussion, debate, what have you, with Mark Collett about the Ukraine war that was just moderated by Joel Davis. I thought Joel did a great job. I'm very happy with how he performed. I think the discussion was more heated than I would have liked it to be, but I think it was a candid airing of differences about the Ukraine war. The first thing I'd like to do, though, is announce that we made our $5,000 matching grant. We had a $5,000 one-week all-or-nothing matching grant that was given by a donor and supporter of Countercurrents who wanted to mark the Columbus Day holiday. And so the Friday before Columbus Day, we announced this. Yesterday on Friday at midnight, we ended it. And we made over $5,000. And so we got the match, which is really nice. That puts us more than 3% of the way further towards our goal this year of $300,000. And we are close to two-thirds of the way to it. And it's only halfway through October. And just to put this in perspective, we're almost 60% of the way to our goal in mid-October. And half of all the fundraising that takes place in America happens in November and December. So we are 60% of the way in October, which means that we are going to easily jog, power walk, relax, stroll across the finish line at the end of the year at $300,000. Knock on wood. So I'm very, very happy about that. And thank you all. There a number of you helped out. And I'm going to thank some of you by name. Sunshine Kid sent 25 euros, very generous. What are some graphic novels you would recommend? Well, not many. I've not really read many graphic novels. In fact, let me think. I've read more than one. I think I've only read two, though. The graphic novel that I thought was fantastic, absolutely fantastic, is Watchmen. I think Watchmen is a 19th century romantic novel disguised as a comic. I think it's superb, and I think the Zack Snyder movie adaptation is superb too, and it actually in some ways improves the story, which is a remarkable thing for a movie adaptation to do. Usually they muck things up, but in this case, Snyder and his scriptwriter had a way of increasing the dramatic tension quite remarkably by basically making Dr. Manhattan into the villain, explicitly into the villain, and then he becomes a scapegoat, which is actually very, very in keeping with his whole sort of avatar-like depiction throughout the graphic novel. So I think it's extraordinarily good. Krister writes in with $50. Question for Greg, how are you doing with your diet? Are you still keto, carnivore? If so, what has been your experience with it? Okay. I've never been a carnivore dieter. I just can't eat all meat because my digestive system just turns into granite mausoleums. if I eat nothing but meat, it's just a miserable experience. I am just a ketogenic dieter. I have a zero carb diet if I can possibly get there. You know, some of the food that it has some carbohydrates in it, but I don't eat grains and stuff like that, breads and potatoes and rice, basically the starchy stuff that we think is part of the four food groups that must belong in every meal. I have eliminated completely. I don't even put sugar or honey in my coffee anymore. I don't drink alcohol. And it's been great for me. It's been great in a number of ways. One, it has, I think, first of all, okay, I was never fat. So I never had to take this to lose weight. But I did want to get leaner. And I got a lot leaner by going keto. But the main thing, the main change that I noticed, and this I think is extremely important, is that by eliminating bread, and I was for years on a low carb diet anyway, but I would have some bread. And I just like to start my day with toast, right? But eliminating bread, I realized that bread was causing all kinds of inflammation in my body, specifically in my knees. And when I was about 30, I started having all kinds of knee pain problems, which I thought came from exercise, from bicycling too much. And I discovered that a lot of that came from consuming citrus juices, citrus fruit. I eliminated that and I got rid of a lot of the knee pain, but it would come back sometimes. And as I got older, I just started noticing I'd be more stiff, less limber, and the knees would be especially the first place I would notice it. Once I got rid of the bread, within about 3 weeks, I suddenly found myself scrambling up and down from the floor to standing back down to the floor. When I would put my shoes on and things like that, I would just, you know, drop down onto the floor, put my shoes on, hop up and leave. And I thought, wait a second, I'm moving like I was when I was a kid. That amazed me. And so any kind of joint pain and stiffness problems that I was getting as I grew older were completely eliminated once I cut all the bread out of my diet. So I thought that was very interesting. There's a lot of aging has to do with inflammation. And I think especially bread and pasta, that kind of stuff with glutens in it, causes inflammation in a lot of people. It certainly was causing inflammation with me. So that's a good question. Thank you. Redline writes in with $10. All this is created. I don't think that people by nature need novelty. Young people who went to the harvest dances in the Middle Ages of the 16th century or 1920 essentially had the same experience, but they were all excited and looked forward to seeing the girls all dressed up and dance with them. I can't disagree with that. Not at all. There's an English writer, kind of a milquetoasty English conservative writer, Michael Oakeshott, who's still rather an elegant stylist, one of the best philosophical stylists in English, I would say. And when he talks about conservatism, he talks about how we should be conservative of all the things that make life good. And basically, the same things make life good in all ages. What we should be progressive about are means, technical means. But in terms of the ends of life, those remain pretty much constant over time. And to be conservative is to recognize the importance of these common ends that we have in life. And therefore, you are going to find that a lot of the things that people most enjoy never really change. They might change superficially. The technologies that surround them might change, right? There are different ways of making music, but the dances, you know, and those activities, those things are constants. Why? Because they're part of just living well. Okay, ABC writes in with $10. Thank you. Victorious warriors win first and then go to war, while defeated warriors go to war first and then seek to win. This is Sun Tzu. Many groups are interested in supporting the decay and degeneration from within the West, and the elites simply don't care what will happen beyond their lifespan. Is that it? Well, I need to puzzle about this. I've used this quote before, victorious warriors win first and then go to war, meaning that most of the victory is in the planning, right? Whereas defeated people, foolish people, they go out and do something and then they hope to get a victory later. I think our movement can learn a lot from that. A lot of activism, for instance, what happened in Charlottesville. A lot of people went into Charlottesville thinking, well, we're just going to do something and then we'll somehow get a victory out of it. They didn't go in with much planning ahead or thinking about contingencies and things like that. And so it was something of a disaster. Now, many groups are interested in supporting the decay and degeneration from within the West. There are people definitely pushing for destruction. And yeah, a lot of elites just don't care. These two forces go together. There's a wonderful passage from Yeats's poem, The Second Coming, that I'm fond of repeating and quoting, "The best lack all conviction, while the worst are full of passionate intensity." That pretty much describes, say, the right and the left, the center right and the left. The best meaning the people who are out there supposedly representing sensible values, the best, lack all conviction, while the worst, namely the left, the people pushing decline, are full of passionate intensity. That differential in intensity will have enormous consequences. And to counter our enemies, we have to up our emotional intensity. The best need to have passionate intensity. And it would be great if the worst lack all conviction. Then we would steamroll them. And that's it for the questions that I've gotten. Let's go and talk a bit about the debate, the discussion. I'm getting some messages here. The chat was a madhouse, like 99.9% Russia shills. A lot of people repeating the same stuff over and over and over again. I am going to... Nick, welcome.
Hey, am I in the show?
Yes, you're in the show. So tell me how you thought it went.
Oh, you want my honest opinion or do you want it filtered for public consumption?
Honest.
I think that you and Mark just completely talked past each other. Not because either of you was dishonest or anything, but I think that the fundamental problem was not that you disagreed over interpretation, but that there was disagreement over facts. And
yeah,
really, when you really got to the nature of the 2014 Maidan revolution or the nature of the referendums in Donbass and Kherson and all these places, the Crimean annexation, the separatist movements in Donbass, one of you says, oh, well, the one was CIA, the other was organic. The other one says, oh, well, Maidan was organic, but these were FSB. Although we do have some serious evidence of Strelkov being involved in Donbass, and he's an FSB colonel, of course. And this is something I said it on Telegram, and I predicted it, not that it takes a lot of skill to predict it, but you and Mark and the pro-Russia people and the pro-Ukraine people live in different empirical and epistemic universes. And I don't think it's possible to debate someone who lives in a different epistemic universe. It's like people debating, oh, whether evolution or creation is true. No, this is an empirical question, which is going to be solved by either gathering evidence or performing an experiment. It's not going to be settled by discourse, only interpretation, where people already agree on the facts, can be settled by discourse. So this is maybe a statement about debate in general, that debate is only really possible between people who already agree on the facts. And then this is probably why you insisted that this would be a friendly airing of positions, as you put it.
You know, what I tried to do is I wanted to get away from all these factoids and these disputes about factoids as much as I could and just get it to the moral principles here of self-determination versus empire and stuff like that. You know, Mark wasn't really game for that. And so we had a different kind of debate. We were talking with past one another. I think part of the talking past one another, though, was an artifact of the question and answer format, because you know we were supposed to just be answering Joel, and we would each give an answer to Joel. But I started working in answers, and he started working in answers. You know, we were working into answers to one another. So we had to sort of do rebuttals on the fly. And so that might have been a little awkward. It certainly wasn't structured in from the start.
Well, no, I mean, if all you do is answer Joel, then what's the point of having it live streamed with both of you present? It's, it provided for good entertainment. I will say, though, that, I mean, I'm just going to read the Telegram post I made after the show was done, because I think it summarizes it. As I predicted, not that it was hard to predict, Greg and Mark talked past each other, couldn't agree on basic facts, and nobody changed his opinion on this conflict as a result of this discourse. And again, my point about the empirical universe, it's the same here. But I did see something in the chat. I saw people who had before would have probably called you a moron if you insulted Mark because you disagree with him, and people who would have called you know, someone a moron if they insulted you, they were wholeheartedly getting in on the whole slinging insults at each other thing. And Joel, I know he prefers a less moderated chat than we have here on Countercurrents. So everyone let it all hang out. This is probably going to have some serious ramification on unity in the white nationalist sphere as regards this conflict. And not to say that people are already saying that we have a serious bifurcation of this movement on empirical grounds. So first of all, half of this movement believes that Azov Regiment is a Zionist op to genocide the children of the Donbas, whereas the other half of this movement believes the complete opposite of that about Azov Regiment, right? So how can we work together? If such a thing had happened in cryptocurrency, we would call it a fork, and we would have two different cryptocurrencies now. We are not living in the same empirical universe as the people who are on the pro-Russian side right now. I don't know what's going to happen to white identitarian nationalism after, not after today, but yeah, I don't know.
Hey, Gadius joins us. How are you doing?
Good. How you doing, Greg? How you doing, Nix? Good to talk to you guys.
Yeah, I've been talking for 2 hours and then I rushed without much planning ahead into a discussion. And I thought, you know, I need to get Gadius in here and Nick and anybody else who will join us. So Gadius, you were doing battle in various chat threads. I mean, what is your impression of how it went, how it started, how it's going? And where is this all going to go? Nick was raising the question, you know, is this a fork? Are we just going to be going off into two different movements entirely over this particular debate? I kind of hope not.
I think basically it's the whole Russia-Ukraine thing is pretty much put to bed. I mean, everybody's dug in to their positions where they're going to be at. And I think the debate was called for, especially after the pipeline thing and the what's been going on lately with Russia, Ukraine. You know, Russia's not really doing that great, or so it seems. So, and, you know, at the beginning of this thing, the quote unquote Russia shills said it would be over in 2 weeks. And here we are, however many months later. And I think a reassessment of the situation and how it pertains to this side of things was in order. Like, you know, there was a post a couple weeks ago by a prominent figure and on this side of things, basically throwing out a challenge for a debate. And it'd been percolating around, like, hey, you guys, there's one side of this movement that's really heavily for, you know, that wants Russia to win. And Mark, he's pretty cool with everybody. You know, he's cool with you. He's cool with, you know, the other people on the other side of the Russia debate, but he's firmly on the pro-Russia side. And I think the debate was definitely called for. It needed to happen. And I was just glad to see that, you know, a reassessment was done. I think you laid your case out clearly, and, you know, the way you do, like a DA, as Jim Goad would say, you lay your case out like a DA. And Mark, he's passionate about his views too. I just think what Nick said about you guys talking past each other, I don't know if you necessarily were talking past each other. It was just that you guys have your views the way you are, and that's just the way it's going to be. And my personal opinion is there's people on this side of things that want so badly for Zog or the globalist American empire or whatever you want to call it to take a L on the world stage, that they want multipolarity in the world, that they're willing to sacrifice. Well, I mean, they're not willing to sacrifice their own stuff, but they're willing to sacrifice, you know, the national sovereignty of another country. And to me, that's unfortunate, because, I mean, what do you do when you empathize with somebody? You put yourself in the position of, you know, somebody else. So, I mean, you got Ukrainians dying, literally dying on the battlefield, being called LARPers by people who are sitting on the internet thousands of miles away.
So that's so hilarious. Yeah, I love that.
But how many bullets do you have to take before you're officially not LARPing but doing the actual thing?
Well, I mean, it's IRL LARPing, so it's not LARPing. It's just IRL, like they're doing.
Yeah, it's IRL, exactly.
Well, LARPing stands for live action role play, which is
at a certain point, it's not a game if people are actually dying. And you can't call those LARPers anymore. You have to say that this has gotten real.
Well, there's something else I also noticed, and it was from early on. It was like the people closest to the situation, like geographically, they're pretty much all of the same voice. You know, this isn't good. Russia is doing is not good. And the further you get away from the Russian border, Western nationalists are more pro-Russia because they're just, I don't know, they're so against, you know, Zog or whatever, that they're willing for anything to happen for Zog to take an L. But it's not necessarily always going to be the case. Like, you know, extraordinary circumstances make strange bedfellows sometimes. And like, what's good for Ukraine, you know, if it's going in the direction that the globalist American empire wants it to go, but it's also going in the same direction that like Ukrainian nationalists, like people fighting for their homeland want to go, then obviously you're going to come down on the same side as like the people mm-hmm. who are sticking up for their homeland. I mean, that's just the way it's going to go. Like sometimes you're going to have to make decisions in life, and you're not going to base all your decisions off of like what your enemies like or what they don't. And that's coming from me, and I'm a respecter of spite in some circumstances. I love to spite my enemies all the time, but it's like mm-hmm. when there's lives on the line and like national sovereignty on the line, that's, you know, you kind of have to.
People assume it's just Ukrainian lives on the line, and even if it were just Ukrainians, it wouldn't make it right. But it's not just Ukrainians, and it's not even just Eastern Europeans. The reality of it is, and I don't know if people have even really taken this into account, that this is why I insist that people read James O'Meara's Enough from the Clown, which is about basically Justin Trudeau. And this was actually touched upon in the quote-unquote debate with Mark. Justin Trudeau invoking the Emergencies Act or the War Powers Act, whatever they call it up in Canada, to trample the trucker protest, right? It's something that I want people to understand very, very, very clearly. Liberals, libtards, our enemy does not fuck around, right? The reason they have been in power and have been winning consistently for 250 and maybe more years is because they don't fuck around. They do not underestimate the enemy. In fact, they overestimate us. They overestimate the white identitarian sphere. They overestimate the dissident right. They overprepare for the threat we represent, and they overreact. And this will, I guess, eventually be their undoing. However, in the meantime, we have to be very careful. It's something that people should keep in mind. Under no interpretation of free speech has sedition ever been illegal. And sedition, cheering on the chief geopolitical rival of the state under whose power you live, irregardless of whether you agree with that state and its policies, is dangerous. At some point, and especially if Russia is victorious in Ukraine, if Globo Homo takes an L in Ukraine, it's going to take it out on domestic distance. It's going to use it as grounds to crack down on everyone who has ever posted a Z on social media. I don't think I would expect something like this from Nick Fuentes, who's immature and impulsive, not from Mark Collett. Not from other people that, let's not mention them for now. I wouldn't even say don't support. Like, if you're pro-Russian, you're pro-Russian. I cannot convince you otherwise. But try not to be very loud in public about it for this particular reason. I don't really care about some of the people whose egregiously, I don't even care about the pro-Russian stuff. What really gets me is the anti-Ukrainian stuff. I don't really even care if they get murked at this point, but some young kid who's been propagandized into saying, oh, Z, Putin base, he's going to get scooped up because it's not even going to be defensible on free speech ground, because whether we like it or not, I mean, there is a conflict, a broader geopolitical conflict between America and Russia. And it is indeed true that America is using this conflict to further its geopolitical aims. This is something that Ukrainians complain about, that they're not being given weapons to push the Russians out, but that right. they're being given weapons piecemeal specifically so this will result in maximum Russian casualties. Which is not the Ukrainian war aim. The Ukrainian war aim is to actually push Russia out. And at that point, the Ukrainians would be willing to have a peace treaty with Russia because they can accept, yeah, Russia is our neighbor. We're going to have to live with them in the future.
Right.
This is something that the American, the NATO side is just not going to accept. They just want to bleed Russia until it keels over. And for that end, they will not adequately arm Ukraine. I don't know. It's like, and the reality of it is, yeah, Global Homo can take an L, but every time they have taken an L, things have gotten worse for us as nationalists, because we are sort of the people in their power on whom they take it out. I mean, it's not really an argument for or against the supporting anyone in the conflict. It is, however, vital to our self-preservation.
Right. Yeah, well, for one thing, I think if it goes nuclear, it's not just going to be them taking it out on scruffy alt-right Twitter trolls and things like that. I think practically anybody who's been a critic of this war is going to be treated like they're seditious. Of course, there might be bigger things to worry about at that point. But, you know, when things go really, really bad, there's a lot of finger pointing and impotent rage is expended on vulnerable people. We've seen that many, many times in history. So yeah, it is dangerous. It's dangerous for these people. And of course, you know, if they're going to be attacking vast swaths of the right, they're not going to be too discriminating about who was on the right side of the war anyway. They're just going to run amok. It's a dangerous situation. And I do want to bring this back to the question of our movement, the safety of our movement, the ability of our movement to operate. Our movement's ability to frame an ethno-nationalist vision of how the world should work has been massively compromised because of Russian propaganda, because of Russian outreach to people in our movement, Russian subversion, to put it bluntly. I started seeing this in 2013, in 2014, when the Maidan was happening, and in the aftermath of that, there was a massive amount of this, and I was fighting against it. And at the time, Richard Spencer was pro-Russia, and his little group of people who were working with him at Radix were. He tried to put on this conference in Budapest in 2014 that was so massively, you know, packed with Eurasianists and Russophiles that, you know, at a certain point, some of the local organizers said enough, you know, and then this was used as one of the excuses by the government to shut it down. They had invited Alexander Dugin, who was being censored or censured at that point for advocating genocide against Ukraine. Spencer's changed his tune. The National Alliance, Kevin Alfred Strom wrote this piece that was absolutely a tissue of delusions about Russia and Ukraine. He was saying, oh, these white nationalists in Ukraine, if they only knew that they were being used to harm Putin, who's the great white hope. I wrote a very long and patient piece. I don't have the patience to write things like that anymore now. It's sad. You look back and you see, oh my God, I'm losing certain abilities. I'm getting old. As I get older, I get impatient. But here's the thing. I dismantled Strom's case. And now the National Alliance has come around on the Russia-Ukraine thing. They're on the right side of this. There's actually a lot fewer people in the American dissident right sphere today who are pushing this strong pro-Russia line. Now, one person who definitely hasn't changed at all is David Duke. And I think that his influence is very strong in what we were hearing from Mark Collett. But there are fewer people doing this. I did a couple of polls, and of course, this went out to my followers first, but then it bounced around Telegram. So I honestly think it's not inadequate or inaccurate because anybody could have voted on it. It was shared in many groups. And I did a poll. This was suggested by Gadius, and it was 5 points. You know, are you strongly pro-Ukraine, moderately pro-Ukraine, indifferent, moderately pro-Russia, or strongly pro-Russia? And both versions of the poll had basically similar results. And the results were about 50% of the people were moderately or strongly pro-Ukraine, and the other 50% were divided between pro-Russians and neutral people. And the number of people who were strongly pro-Ukraine was double the percentage of the number of people who were strongly pro-Russia. And I thought that was very, very interesting. And I wish I had taken this poll around, well, February 24th to see if there's been a change. I think there has been a change. I think there's been erosion of support for Russia. And I think that the fact that the number of people who are strongly pro-Ukraine is larger than the number of people who are strongly pro-Russia, well, that's that differential of emotional intensity that I was talking about with the Yates quote. And that will have long-term enormous consequences, because the more intense the pro-Ukraine side is, the more they're going to bite into the pro-Russia side. Now, I think Joel's chat is brigaded by Russia shills, and so I think that their reactions are definitely weighted by that. But let's see, as his poll is shared around more broadly on Telegram, how the results go. Right now, I guess 2/3 of the people in Joel's chat think that this was a crushing victory for Mark Collett, and the other third think that I won. Let's see how this goes. Even if people think that Mark did a better job at debating, though, I do think that the dynamic is on the Ukraine side. And I think that this is going to continue. I've had people reach out to me who were pro-Russia at the beginning of this and are now just sort of disillusioned and thinking that Putin is a disaster and so forth. So I have anecdotal evidence of this kind of shift, as well as looking at stats. And it's very interesting. A poll on Twitter was giving similar results. Of course, that's a vastly different audience than right-wing Telegram.
Yeah. Something to bring it back around to what you were talking about at the beginning, what the implications for the movement. There's something we need to think about is like deference, right? What are we trying to do here on this, you know, on this side of things? Turn the metapolitical into the political. We're trying to get our guys, you know, into positions of power and influence, right? Like, I'm sure PA would love to be a political party by now. I'm sure, like, the American movement would love to have somebody in Congress repping for them, like, you know, laying down the law. We got to settle for Blake Masters, J.D. Vance, and people like that. Steve King got the boot out of Congress a couple years ago for getting too close to this side of things. And like I said, PA would love to field candidates and get elected. Well, we have somebody in Estonia, Ruben Kaalep, who's literally our guy. Like, he's every one of our guys, even the pro-Russia guys. Like, he's their guy too. Like, he's got the same worldview, the same politics, everything, ethno-nationalism all the way. And at the very beginning of this conflict, he wrote a piece. He was shilling for NATO, but he's our guy. He's like, he knows, though. He's right next to Russia. So it's like, where does deference come in? Do we just like say, no, you don't know what you're talking about, Ruben over there in Estonia, right next to, you know, Russia. I know what's best for your country. Me over here in America,
right,
typing on Telegram. It's like, we want people in positions of power and influence in this movement, but we shit can it. We shit can like whatever they have to say because, oh no, because Zog wants Ukraine to win. It's like, no, you gotta like think a little bit deeper than that. Right.
Right. You know, another thing here, and I've said this before, is so many people let their enemies choose their friends. So the people you don't like on Twitter like Ukraine, so you decide, well, you have to be against Ukraine. And it's just, it's shameful. It's passive. It's shameful. It's merely reactive. It's not using your intelligence. It's not a good thing. It's not a good look for nationalists. But yeah, when you look at somebody like Rubin, Rubin is in parliament. And he is our guy. He's spoken at American Renaissance twice now, and he's coming for his third time. This is great. He might not be able to get in because of this COVID stuff, but he'll probably speak remotely or something again. But anyway, he's a good guy. And like most of the Eastern European nationalists that I know, Eastern European ethno-nationalists that I know, he's definitely on the Ukraine side. Most of the peoples who were ruled by the Russian Empire want security guarantees against that ever happening again. We can understand that, and it doesn't make them chumps. It just makes them rational actors in an imperfect world. And yeah, they're fully aware of all the problems of Western Europe, fully aware of the EU, fully aware of America, fully aware of all the dangers, and they still want in because it's better given their circumstances. And we need to respect that. And this is what I've tried to do. And it's just so tiresome when you say, look, I see the rationality of 15 former Soviet bloc countries joining NATO. And they'll say, do you believe in the Judeo-American hegemony? It's like, no. I'm just pointing out that it's rational, given an imperfect world, for these people to want to get involved in this. And, you know, the people who say, oh, the Americans are just using the Ukrainians. Well, let's give the Ukrainians a little credit, too. They're using the Americans as well, including Ukrainian nationalists are using the West. You know, if my country were under attack, I would definitely make all kinds of alliances of convenience. This is realism. You know, we're at realism, and realism is big countries bullying little countries. But when we point out that realism also would dictate that small countries have bigger countries as allies, then they say, oh, no, that's cheating. Suddenly there's a norm here, right? It's not just realism, not just amoral realism anymore. Suddenly there are rules, and the rules are that Ukraine should have allowed itself to be defeated rather than have bad people help it out, which is just ridiculous. Basically, foreign policy realism in these debates pretty much goes right up to where Russia gets its way, and then it stops. And then everything else is just a matter of moral norms. Moral norms that help Russia get its way too. Isn't that convenient? Let's see if we got some more questions here. ABC writes in with $10. Thank you. Mark Collett seems to believe that anything that opposes the Jews in America is good. That's a false statement based on an incorrect historic understanding of Russian imperialism. Does he think that ultimately Eurasianism, Islamic extremism, and Chinese domination of the world is good? Well, yeah, That's a question for Mark.
Let's not put words in his mouth.
Well, but let's...
That's one thing I would have asked, though. I'd have been like, look, you can get grug-brained about it and be like, so is Russia allowed to invade the UK because the UK's vassal state of Zog or whatever, right? I mean, you can just get it down to something as simple as that. Like, what if Putin wanted to quote-unquote liberate the UK? Would he be allowed to invade there? I'm pretty sure the position would be a little different then, you know? No, it's totally different because Ukraine is actually Russia, blah, 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 whatever. Yeah. But when you're talking about the principle of ethnic self-determination, national sovereignty, no, it's the exact same thing applies. Like, you've got ethnic homelands and sovereignty over them.
Right. Well, there is this criterion that's used in a lot of these discussions, which is basically, I'll call it the one drop rule. It's if there's one Jew, you know, one drop of Jewish involvement in anything, it's completely compromised. Now, that doesn't apply to Putin, of course. right? It doesn't apply to the National Justice Party or TRS. So the one drop of Jewish association disqualify stuff is always used in a very inconsistent way. But it's enough to get some people salivating. Oh, Jews are involved in this. Oh my God. You say the word Jew, knee jerks, brain goes blank, jaw drops open, tongue lolls out. And it's so tiresome. It's so very tiresome. The truth is that this isn't a Jew versus non-Jew thing, because there are Jews on all sides of this, sadly. There are Jews in Russia whispering in Putin's ear. There are Jews in Ukraine. There are Jews in Washington, D.C. They're all playing their little games. But again, there's something a little nutty to assume that all the other groups involved don't have any agency here, right? Only Jews have agency here. Only Jews are getting their way. Only Jews can win. So we better let Putin win. I just think that that's kind of paranoid and goofy sounding. And again, it can't be applied consistently here. I know Andrew Anglin just started reeing when I said, look, there are Jews on all sides of this, so it's not a Jew versus non-Jew thing. Well, he can ree all he wants, but it's just the truth. One of my favorite newspaper headlines of all time, you can Google it if you want, which is a dirty word. You can DuckDuckGo it if you want. An army of Jewish billionaires by his side. Putin dedicates a monument to the Red Army in Israel. That says it all to me. Putin, monument to Red Army, Israel, surrounded by a bunch of Jewish billionaires. He's got lots and lots of very Jewish friends. And the Chabadniks have his, you know, private phone. They're speed dialing him all the time. He's just as thick with these people as Trump was. You know, it's a different Jewish mafia than the crazed Anthony Blinken, Victoria Nuland Jewish mafia. It's a different Jewish mafia, but they're still mobbed up.
In the Russian case, in the Chabadnik case, literally, because, and I was discussing this with a friend, because my recent for Countercurrents is called Western Promises, right?
Well, which is an excellent piece that everybody should be reading, and it should be linked in the chat here. So go ahead.
Yeah, I'm sure the tireless and indomitable moderators shall look to it. However, we were discussing basically the genesis of the Russian mafia, and I objected to it being called the Russian mafia because it is predominantly staffed by Jews and Caucasoids, so Georgians and to a lesser degree Armenians. So it's a basically a KGB project, which has taken over the old Vorovzakone culture and used it to both control the Russian black market during the Soviet period and to provide black funds for the state. So unofficial funds for the Soviet state, unofficial means of obtaining resources and technology. And after the USSR collapsed, these people went private, part of them, but they still have their FSB contacts, and it's still part and parcel of the Russian state. So in their case, I know you like to use this term Jewish mafia informally, but in the case of the Chabadniks and the quote-unquote Russian mafia, they are literally mobbed up. They are literally the guys from Eastern Promises, the guys smuggling drugs and migrants, smuggling, you know, slave girls to Israel for use in the prostitution and pornography industries. Literally the guys dealing Kalashnikovs to various African and Central Asian militias. And of course, the Orthodox Jews of America are also mobbed up, and not letting the American Jews off the hook as well. Meyer Lansky was running a protection racket on every organized crime gang in America for as long as he had compromat on J. Edgar Hoover, essentially, which was 50 years. So it's not just metaphor and hyperbole when we say that Jews are mobbed up. In many cases, in the American and Russian case, they literally are the mafia. They're right. Fewer Russians, right? Not just it's not just disproportionate representation. There are fewer Russians than Jews in the so-called Russian mafia.
Friedrich is joining us. Can you hear us?
Yes, I can hear. I was just taking a break, waiting for for you to call me in. So where to start?
Well, what are your thoughts about the discussion and where the movement is going on all this? You are from a former communist country. Would you like to comment on the wondrous socially conservative effects of communism on your homeland?
We're reading my mind. So Nix just published an article, describing, like a generic case of common man trying to make it in one of our countries. And, for some of you, this might seem as, I don't know, maybe unusual or like a story or something, but in these places, it's something like a cliche. So he's not only right, so he's describing reality, right? So it's
literally the biographies of two people I know glued together.
No, but I don't want to go into details, not about me, right? So, but, I know a lot of people who are in Canada and in the States, and, they were exactly like Nick described, from the countryside or from a smaller town. They tried to do something, they had good grades in school and, they were hardworking, honest, whatever, all the qualities of the white man. And, they couldn't make it here. And, they left the country. And even now, right, I mean, all the kids in high school, they are thinking, I'm going to finish high school and then, I'll apply for a grant or a subsidy or something like that. And I'll get it. And most of the time they get it because they have good grades. And, I leave. Everybody wants to leave. It's very hard for a person like that, when they've been looking all their lives towards the West as a, shining light, not only because of propaganda, to turn their minds around and see exactly the West for what it is.
And there are some things about the West that aren't so damn bad. When these shit libs, pardon my French, in the West accuse the Polish government or the Hungarian government of violating the rule of law, it's obnoxious because actually what they're doing is they're cleaning out communist patronage networks in their institutions so that the institutions can actually work. And yet this is decried as violating the rule of law. Whereas the truth is that it's clearing out patronage networks and corruption that allows you to have rules, objective rules that any outsider can walk into a public building, a government office, and expect the same treatment. We have that in the West. For all of our problems, there is not this kind of routine corruption on the retail level in every government office like you have in a lot of these Eastern countries today. And we should love that. We should value that and feel good about that and understand why people envy that. I know many people in Ukraine, very good people who want to be more like the West because they simply don't want to live in a society where basically talent is throttled by mediocrities with power running patronage networks and basically robbing the country blind. That's no way to run a country. And the West is better than that, and they're not wrong to think that.